My guest is Jeffrey Kripal. We're talking about his new book, Mutants and Mystics, about legends and myths and realities, how they evolve, how they change over the years. That song from the Beatles, Eleanor Rigby, kind of a song with its own mythology. I think you probably know some of this. McCartney has said when he wrote it, it originally started with a tale about a lady named Daisy Hawkins who became Eleanor Rigby. Years later, people found a gravestone in this church where Lennon and McCartney first met, and the gravestone had the name Eleanor Rigby on it. So McCartney admits that maybe some sort of subliminal memory was triggered when he was writing that song. Either way, the discussion of memories, collective memories, mythologies is our topic tonight with Jeffrey Kripal. We're going to get into the X-Men. It was born in the 60s in the mind of Stan Lee and his collaborators. But at the same time, there was something very close to a school for X-Men in real life. And we'll ask Jeffrey Kripal about that when we come back here on Coast to Coast. Jeffrey, as you know, in the whole UFO discussion, it seems like solid proof is always just tantalizingly out of our grasp that, the critics will say, so where's the cigarette lighter from the UFO? Yeah, sure, you saw a flying saucer, but it left no physical evidence. It was there one minute, it was gone the next. The aliens were there, they didn't leave any footprints or anything. And that isn't exactly what you write about in the chapter called Orientation, but it's close. You talk about this search for truth that is always just sort of tantalizingly out of our grasp. In one way is because of the what you call the somewhere else that's reflected in a lot of different ways, different places far away, over the world, under the world. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, that's chapter one. It's called Orientation. It's a play on the Orient, the East. The subtitle is From India to the Planet Mars. And basically what I do in that first chapter is show how, if you look at the 19th century, the sort of origins of science fiction, you have all of these esoteric or mystical movements flowing around at that point, particularly something called theosophy. And what you see is that the essentially heaven or the other world begins to shift, where in earlier generations, the place of revelation was in the Far East, or it was in the sky, or it was in the hollow earth, or it kind of shifts around. It's always somewhere else. The sacred always has to come from somewhere else. It's tough. It doesn't show up in your breakfast table. It comes from somewhere else. And what happens in the 19th century is, as Western culture colonizes the planet and we essentially go everywhere, the source of the sacred shifts to outer space. At the end of the 19th century, we're basically on Mars in terms of the religious imagination.
I mean, is it as simple as saying that Mount Olympus was replaced by heaven, the Christian version of heaven?
Well,
as one world above, that is? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this notion of worlds above, I mean, heaven itself is a really complicated history. And, we tend to think of it as up because that's how we're oriented physically. But in fact, if you look at the history of heaven, it's not always up. It's inside as well. It's within. And again, I think this is the problem with all of, you open this question with this lack of hard physical proof. I think this all goes back to that. I think there's a kind of literalism that is sort of rampant in this discussion. And there's a kind of a lack of sophistication around what a religious or a spiritual reality is. And that these things might, in fact, be, spirits, not aliens with vehicles you could go up and kick the tires, as it were. I think that's a literalism. It's a kind of a naive literalism that we're working with here.
Well, it sort of grows out of the religion of science, doesn't it? That if it's not something that we can see and measure and weigh, then it doesn't exist.
That's right. That's the basic problem right there. That's it. And of course, what I'm trying to do in this book and what I tried to do in my last book is show that, again, if you look at paranormal experiences, they're not about math and mechanism. They're about meaning and myth. They're about story. They're about mind or consciousness. And, of course, what our sciences can do so much, and they're so successful at everything they do, we assume that they know everything or eventually will. And of course, what they don't know is what mind is or what consciousness is. And I think that's the real mystery here. And And that's ultimately what the paranormal is about. It's about us. It's about the scope and limits of mind. And there may be no limits there. I think that's what the history suggests.
You mentioned about the different kind of movements that were sort of sprouting up all over the place at the birth of some of these stories, some of the legends, myths, themes. The Rosicrucians is one that you look at pretty significantly in the book. What do you make of those guys?
Well, the Rosicrucians are a perfect example of this theme we introduced earlier about the trick and the truth. The Rosicrucians were, and probably still are around, a group of individuals who claimed a kind of secret brotherhood that went back to, their own essentially saint or founder. And what's so interesting about the history of the Rosicrucians is that it, first of all, you get all the themes of the superhero there. You get secret identities, you get superpowers, you get secret brotherhood, these figures moving among society in a hidden way. I mean, these are essentially superheroes. And the Rosicrucian story was almost certainly a conscious fiction. The man who wrote it as fiction. But probably as a fiction trying to communicate a real truth. And then it was taken up and believed to be real. And so you have this wonderful story of this group that was made up, but then became real.
People were mad about it. No, people were mad, weren't they? Don't tell me there's no Rosicrucians. I'm a Rosicrucian kind of thing.
Right. And of course, those people were right. They were Rosicrucians. And so, this is, again, this is essentially what religion is. It's a set of stories that people make up at some point, but seem to be based on real events and then kind of take on a life of their own. And so I think the Rosicrucians is a perfect example of how something like science fiction or comic books can essentially become a religious movement in some way, even though people know it's made up, as it were.
I don't know if you remember this, and I don't know if you can't mention this in the book. I don't recall seeing it, but I remember reading comic books as a kid. The first time I ever heard about the existence of the Rosicrucians were those little ads in the back of a lot of these comic books. They would advertise in comic books, and I wonder if that was on purpose.
Isn't that amazing? It's funny you say that, George. I almost put a Rosicrucian ad in as an illustration in the book because they're everywhere in the Pulp Fiction magazines. If you just open up any Pulp Fiction magazine from the 40s, you will see sometimes two or three ads from the Rosicrucians, and they're all promising things like, superpowers.
Yeah.
So it's this fusion, right? This fusion of fantasy and what's claimed to be fact. When I was a kid, it was all about martial arts. You would pick up a comic book, a Kung Fu Master or something, and there would be all these ads in the back on how to master some secret deadly touch or some martial art. And of course, we ordered all that stuff.
Well, I was enthralled by this story about the Rosicrucians, and I just remember what a strange word it was. It stuck in my head for a long time. It wasn't until decades later I learned anything about it. And at that time, when I was first reading it, I was much more interested in X-ray eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The X-ray eyes ads for those things.
Right. This is the 12-year-old boy. I mean, we ordered everything. I didn't order the sea monkeys, actually. I kind of drew the metaphysical line about right there.
So Rosicrucians are still around. Have you had contact with them? I mean, is it like the Freemasons? Can you get in, or you have to be invited? Will they talk about what they do?
Oh no, there are a lot of Rosicrucian groups. The biggest one, or one of the most important ones, is actually out in California. It's just south of San Francisco. They got a big campus there. I have not worked with the Rosicrucians myself. All the stuff on Rosicrucianism I got from a European colleague who works on the tradition, and I just had long conversations with him, and of course I read their material. I did not work with the Rosicrucians.
Let's talk about Superman for a moment. You get into him in this chapter, and you these two guys who created Superman back in, I guess, the 30s.
38.
Well, 38.
They created him before that, but they didn't get it sold till 38.
A certain irony, I guess, involved in the whole idea of Superman, which is first mentioned, I think, in Nietzsche, which is adopted, of course, by the Nazis. They sort of appropriated it into their own mythology. And the two guys that I guess who had created the Superman were Jewish guys. Hello? I am uncertain if we are. Jeffrey, can you hear me? I don't know. It sounds like we have lost Jeffrey there. Gina, maybe you can tell me if we're attempting to get him back. Hello? Folks, I don't know if the radio audience can hear me or not, but I am pretty much lost contact with our guest, and I'm not hearing from the radio station at all. So I'm just talking here and hoping that somebody's going to come on and let me know if this program is still on the air or not. Well, if you are still listening and I am still broadcasting, we will attempt to reconnect with our guest. We have a lot more to talk about in mutants and mystics, the science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal with my guest, Jeffrey Kripal. And I'm not sure if you are still hearing me or not. Well, I am guessing that we have lost our signal here, so I'm hoping we're going to be able to reconnect soon. Hello? Well, folks, I am told now that we are on the air. I'm sorry about that miscommunication there. I was just talking to Gina back at Coast to Coast and trying to figure out whether or not we had lost our guest and lost our signal. And I guess the answer is we have not lost it. So you've been listening to some interesting chatter between us there. I'm going to try to fill a little bit of time here now while we're waiting for to reconnect with my guest, Jeffrey Kripal, author of this new book, Mutants and Mystics. And I don't know if a mutant or a mystic has intervened here to interfere with our signal, but we're trying to continue on. I mentioned earlier one of the stories in the NAPS news section dealing with a new planet that's been discovered, a still-forming alien solar system which has enough water in its outer reaches to fill Earth's oceans several thousand times over, has been discovered in this new study. This discovery marks the first time that astronomers have detected water in a dusty planet-forming disk so far from its central star in the frigid region where comets are born. Scientists think that comet impacts delivered most of Earth's water, and this new study hints that alien planets may commonly acquire oceans in this same way. We now know that large amounts of water ice are available in planet-forming disks ready to be incorporated in comets, says this scientist from the Leiden Observatory in the Netherlands. He's the lead author of this study. Ultimately, some of this water may end up on Earth-like planets that form completely dry, but this way may end up with life-supporting oceans. This scientist and his team made this find using the European Space Agency's Herschel Space Observatory. They trained Herschel on an appropriate name, young star TW Hydrae, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, is located about 175 light years away in the constellation Hydra. TW Hydrae is an orange dwarf star, slightly smaller and dimmer than our sun. It's only about 10 million years old and is still surrounded by a disk of dust and gas that should one day coalesce to form planets, these researchers said. Herschel detected huge amounts of water, thousands of times more water than it's found on Earth, in the freezing cold outer reaches of this disk, far from TW Hydrae itself. The water's out there. It's likely ice that's coating the innumerable tiny dust grains that swirl around in the disk, these researchers said. Ultraviolet radiation from TW Hydrae knocks out some of the water molecules, knocks them free from these icy grains, allowing Herschel to spot the light signature from the resulting vapor. I'm sorry, I didn't hear. I just got a message on my ear and wasn't quite sure what that said. Guest is back. Great. Boy, am I glad to hear that. Jeffrey, glad to have you back with us.
Hey, we got to stop talking about Superman. Every time we talk about Superman, something goes wrong. So I don't know what that is.
All right. Well, let's leave out Superman and we'll just go back to the question about the authors. Nietzsche. Is it okay for us to talk about Nietzsche?
Yeah, let's see. I'm fine talking about anything, but our phone system seems to not like it. So yeah. Nietzsche was, of course, the philosopher who coined this term Übermensch or Overman or Superman, and that almost certainly was one of the influences on Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
And okay, so the Nazis appropriated this thing, and I remember you mentioning in the book that if the Nazis ever got to America, these two guys were warned they'd be hung at particular lampposts in Times Square.
Yeah, this is Jack Kirby you're thinking of. Jack Kirby was the artist what would become Marvel Comics eventually, who helped create a number of these superheroes, including Captain America. And, they were very upset. The first issue of Captain America actually has Captain America punching out Hitler on the front cover. So this is, again, what the superheroes were created to do in their earliest years.
I'm jumping ahead here, but I mentioned this in sort of the tease at the beginning of the hour. It's about the X-Men. And this sort of gets into something that you were involved in, the Esalen. You make comparisons between the school for the X-Men that's described in the comics and something else that was going on in real life at the same time.
Right. This actually is the origin of the book, George. I'm still very involved in the Esalen Institute. Michael Murphy's a dear friend of mine. I work with him really weekly. But the first seven, 8 years of the millennium, I spent writing a history of the Esalen Institute. And as I was finishing that project, I became obsessed with these comic books from my youth, and I couldn't at first make the connection between writing about Esalen and being obsessed with my childhood. But I eventually realized that the basic mystical worldview of Esalen is that evolution is driving us forward, and that psychical abilities and spiritual experiences are essentially these buds of our evolving supernature, the future of the body, as Mike likes to call it.
Hey, the Grateful Dead are telling me where it's time for a break. Jeffrey, I'm glad to have you back, and I'm hoping that gods and aliens will allow us to continue our conversation. This is Touch of Grey taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. I think the timing of that song is perfect, Mysterious Ways. We still have a little mystery here, not quite sure what happened. A lot of you have written notes to me that let me know we're still on the air. I'm not quite sure how long, but of course, not only did we lose the guest, but I was unable to communicate with the folks at Premiere there, so had no idea what was going on. Looked like we had lost the signal, but I am told that the backup program kicked in, so you were listening to a previously recorded program for a while. Sorry about that, folks, and I really do hope that does not continue, and we'll carry on with my guest, Jeffrey Kripal, author of the new book, Mutants and Mystics. We're getting into some good stuff now. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey Kripal, let's talk for a moment about alien sort of images. You get into this in one of your chapters about the consistency of images all the way through for a long, long time. We see them now as aliens, as described, for example, by Whitley Strieber, whom you interview or who you mention in the book. But those kind of images have been around for a long time, right?
Yeah, they have, actually. I trace them in the book. We have hints of them already back in the 19th century with a very strange and wonderful novel called Eti Dorpa by a man named John Uri Lloyd. But then they carry through the 20th century. And, you know, one of my pet theories, it's really maybe an obsession, is the similarities between some of the images of aliens and abduction narratives and Spider-Man. One of the things I do in the book is I just lay out a drawing of an alien that an abductee drew, and then show you what Spider-Man looks like in one of his many renditions, and how incredibly similar those images are. And then show that, you know, the first full abduction report we get, which is Barney and Betty Hill, Barney actually draws eyes in one of his hypnotic sessions that essentially a Spider-Man eye with a pupil, and I show that there could have well been some bleed through there, because Spider-Man was around about 2-3 years when Barney was hypnotized. So again, we're in this situation where something real has happened, and we're getting bleed through from the popular culture.
Well, Whitley Strieber, of course, describes the same kind of aliens, the bug-eyed aliens, black-eyed aliens. There was an attempt, you mentioned the Betty and Barney Hill case, there was an attempt, as you note in the book, to sort of discredit them because of some Twilight Zone episode or other kind of cultural influences.
Right. And so I take that a little further and say, well, you know, there's not just Twilight episode, there's Spider-Man, which would have been all over every drugstore in the country, you know, so you could have seen that as well. But again, I'm not convinced that explains it. That really doesn't explain it, because we see these same eyes, as I point out, Actually, they've been in South Asia for probably millennia. You see them on contra goddesses all over the place. You just go to India and look at Kali. I mean, she basically has Spider-Man's eyes. So again, I don't think you can explain that away that easily. I think this is something in the species. It's been there a long, long time, and it appears all over the place.
Meaning something in the species that people have been seeing something with eyes like that for a long time?
Right. Yeah, I mean, in the species, I just mean it's in our history, it's in our cultural DNA. It's not restricted to America. It's not restricted to the 20th century. People have been seeing these things, these big-eyed beings, for a long, long time. I think that's pretty clear.
Not only big-eyed beings, but beings with no eyes. There's an amazing piece of
Yeah.
art that's in the book. It's the title, the phrase under it is "Confronted by a Singular-Looking Being." Tell
Yeah.
us that story.
It's an amazing thing. This is one of the real surprise discoveries for me researching this book. I ran across a book called Eti d'Orpa. It's Aphrodite spelled backwards, and it's by a man named John Uri Lloyd. It's a Hollow Earth novel. It's clearly presented as a piece of fiction, but it's a piece of fiction trying to communicate a set of what looked like real experiences. Lloyd, believe it or not, this is going back to the psychedelic thesis. He was one of the 19th century's big experts on drugs. He knew about all sorts of drugs. He was a early pharmacologist. He wrote a textbook on drugs. And some people have speculated, I think with real plausibility, that he was taking these things. And so some of these experiences in the book may be based on that. He creates this novel where there's a guide. There's a gray guide. He has the color of gray putty, is what the novel says. He's about 5 feet tall, and he has no eyes. And he basically looks like an alien without the eyes. And then there's another character in the book, simply called I Am the Man, who has this huge forehead, immense forehead. And the novel suggests that he may be from another planet. So already in 1895, you have this huge forehead and this small gray humanoid, and all you're missing are the eyes, and of course you're literally missing those. So it's just very strange. And then we go from there.
We mentioned a moment ago Whitley Strieber. Obviously, you've had some contact with him and interacted and interviewed him. What's your take on Whitley Strieber? I'll preface it with my own, is that I know he's controversial. A lot of people think he's a novelist who made this stuff up. I've always felt that what he's relating to the world are things that he thinks really did happen to him, whether it's a literal truth or not. I've always thought he was being honest in describing the things that happened to him, and I've found him to be one of the most literate and smartest guys in the whole field.
I'm with you on that, George. I've invited Whitley to Esalen a couple times. I've spent, a week or so with him. I've visited with him, corresponded with him. I end this book with him. There's an entire chapter just on Whitley. It's chapter 7, called The Third Kind. My reading of Whitley is that he's probably one of the most sophisticated writers in this whole zone. And the reason I say that is all of his writing really orbits around what he calls keeping the question open, and sitting in this sort of paradoxical notion that these things are real, but they're not literal. Something is being encountered in the environment that's incredibly powerful, but it's also being mediated through my imagination, my literary habits, my horror fiction. And if you sit down and talk to Whitley, he's very clear about that. He's very clear about that in his books. I think he's essentially was assaulted, traumatized, abducted, whatever language you want to use, but also changed by the process. And he spent the rest of his life just trying to figure it out in a very brave and very public way. And I personally have nothing but admiration for what he's done.
I guess the question would be, the central question would be, if I were sitting in the forest outside of his cabin when this stuff was going on, would I see it?
Right. I suspect not. Yeah, I suspect not, because but I don't know that. I mean, he would tell you that other people did see these things, that they didn't see what he saw, but they saw lights, they saw they even saw aliens at different points at the cabin. But again, I don't think we're talking about something like a chair or a truck or a plane here that is simply existing out there as a physical object. I think we're dealing with something essentially spiritual or a cult in the positive sense of the word.
So in that sense, I wonder, are these events, are these experiences meant to challenge us, to get us out of the paradigm of looking for physical proof, out of the scientific paradigm, that whoever these visitors are, these intelligences, that they're not going to make it easy for us by leaving behind a cigarette lighter from a flying saucer, or it's meant to be challenging, it's meant to make us think outside the box?
I think that is the point. I mean, you know, this is actually a very old reading. This is essentially what Jung argued in his little book on flying saucers in 1958, that they're essentially there to challenge our materialist mechanical worldview. And other people have argued that since, people like George Hansen, who talks about the paranormal as a trickster, and of course, Valet. And I try to argue something very similar in the Authors of the Impossible book. We live in a world in which the real is only the material. It's only what can be measured. It's only what you can attach a number to, whether that number is your bank account or a scientific experiment. Things that can't be measured are not real. And these events that are happening to so many people, and again, have always been happening, cannot be measured. And they're there, I think, to frustrate that materialism and to frustrate that scientism, really, that wants to restrict what's real to only what can be measured.
One of the things we measure, at least we pretend to measure it, is time. And you mentioned this earlier, you wanted to get into this. So, you know, we measure it in a linear sense. It's 1 minute later now than it was a minute ago,
right?
Whereas time may or may not be linear. It may not travel in one direction. Get into the whole concept of time and how it fits into with this paradigm that you're exploring.
Well, again, this is one of the sort of happy surprises for me. You know, when you write a book and research a book, you spend 4 or 5 years just digging in, and you kind of have a sense of what you'll find, but of course you don't know all you'll find. And one of the things that came up over and over again in these authors and artists is their argument or their experience that time was not simply linear, that it wasn't just the tick-tock of the clock, that one could enter a space really entirely outside of that time, and that, you know, we can talk about this as eternity, we can talk about this as some kind of existence outside of the space-time continuum, we can use scientific language, but this comes up over and over and over in these authors, that they were propelled outside of linear time and experienced some kind of immortality or eternity outside time. And then it gets really weird. You get into a figure like Philip K. Dick, and he starts to speculate about sort of backward causation with the future, you know, coming back to the present and affecting the present. And so you get all these time loops, essentially.
Well, it makes you wonder, too, about his experience with what it's called Valis, I think it is.
Valis, yeah.
Valis, this thing that appears to him, and whether it's because he's a writer and has an open mind, or because he was chosen as somebody who is a conduit for this information, or... which, again, it's the chicken and egg kind of a question.
Yeah, or again, you know, with Dick, everybody always invokes the drugs. Again, he was an addictive drug user for much of his life. And my own sense is that, you know, those drugs probably did impact the way his brain worked and probably did open him up to other things. And so, again, it's a both and. The really interesting case in the book for me around time is Barry Windsor Smith. And Barry, somebody who's really a legend in the comic book world. He's a very accomplished fantasy artist. He was the young artist in the early 70s who made the Conan the Barbarian series what it was and what it became. And what happened to Barry was he was He was working on Conan, actually, a Conan story for Marvel Comics in 1970, 71, somewhere in there. And he has a daydream in which he sees this office scene and these two men and these women talking, and he sees it, all these details, and then the daydream goes away. And then a couple days later, he's literally drawing a page, and the page disappears, and underneath the page he sees this traffic scene with these big white trucks stalled in the intersection. 3 years later, move ahead 3 years later, he's in New York now. He's working for Marvel. He's in an art studio. And that exact office scene plays out in front of him. And a few hours or a few days later, I don't recall, the traffic scene then plays out. And so he gets caught in this notion that he had somehow had a three-year precognition, essentially. And that then catalyzes a whole series of these openings, and he gets caught in these time loops and these sort of metaphysical revelations that go on for months. And this is what leads to his essay called Time Rise, which is, again, all about how time is not one but two. You have the tick-tock of the clock, and then you have this state of eternity out completely outside of time.
One of the other things you get into the chapter about alienation is the idea of an Akashic record, that there's some gigantic pile of where all information, all knowledge is gathered. That concept has been around a long time. I'm kind of thinking whether or not the rise of the internet could actually lead to an explanation of how that becomes real, that at some point you don't need computers, that it's all just floating around us in the ether somewhere.
Right. Or that, again, I always resist a bit the technological moves, because I think they're forms of literalism again. I think what the Akashic Record stuff is about, you're thinking of Ray Palmer, the Pulp Fiction editor. You know, what Palmer was really talking about was mind with a capital M. This realm of mind that is in touch with all of the past, all of the future, all of the present. In some ways, it exists outside of space-time again, and so it has access to all information, all events. And that's a very common claim in the history of religion and mystical literature. Palmer didn't make that up. That goes all the way back to Plato, at least, you know, who essentially argued that when we invent a new mathematical principle or come across a real philosophical insight, we're actually not learning anything new. We're remembering something that we already knew on some other plane or in some other life.
Let's stay with Ray Palmer for a second, because, wow, what a character. I knew nothing about this guy. Tell the audience some of the works that he did that they would be familiar with, that they know the comic book realm, and then describe sort of the real life experiences that this guy had that made him into the person he became.
Well, Ray Palmer is, again, one of the jewels or gems of the book, I think. Palmer, probably don't know anything he wrote. Palmer was one of the key editors of Pulp Fiction in the 40s and 50s. He was hit by a butcher truck when he was a boy, broke his back, and stopped his growth plates, or however that works. So he was literally basically a midget. I think he was like not even 5 foot tall. And while he was in traction as a boy, he essentially started to develop what we call psychical or precognitive capacities. And he was strapped into one of these horrible, you know, beds, stretching him out, trying to heal his broken back. And he developed these abilities, he claimed, to remember back before he was conceived. And as a young man, he began to have dreams. Some dreams were black and white, and other dreams were in color. And the dreams in color, he eventually realized, were essentially clairvoyant or dreams. And so he would use those dreams to write his Pulp Fiction stories. And he claimed that there. Sometimes what would happen, he'd write a story he thought was fiction, and someone would contact him and show them it had in fact actually happened that way. And so he became just fascinated with paranormal powers and psychical abilities, and wove those into Pulp Fiction in the 40s, particularly through his relationship with a man named Richard Shaver.
Didn't he describe sort of a river in Africa, some ancient civilization or something in Africa that had not been discovered but not announced? And the guy who'd been working on it contacts him, and surely you have been there and seen this thing.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the early stories that he realized he had was actually writing about something that was real. Yeah.
And he supposedly or purportedly cured some disease that was ready to kill him.
Well, he claims he cured his back at later in life. The broken back was returning, and there was some kind of disease that set in, and he claims he cured it just by willing it. And again, a kind of the power of the mind over matter, as it were. And he, by the way, was also very close to Ken Arnold, who I'm sure many of your listeners know about. And he published it was Palmer who started Fate magazine, by the way, with a friend. And on the cover of issue number one in the spring of 1948 is none other than Ken Arnold's plane and the famous saucers, flying saucers that Ken Arnold helped bring into the culture.
And you describe in the book that the choice of the word, the name Fate, was somewhat ironic, since Ray Palmer didn't believe in fate.
No, not at all. He believed in the power of the mind and the power of will and our ability to essentially write our own futures. He hated the concept of fate. And he kind of jokes about, why they called the magazine that. I'm not really clear why they called it that, because he clearly didn't believe in it.
And in the end, how much credence do you give? I guess that's a dumb question in the context of our interview here, is that whether you're supposed to believe it or not believe it.
Believe what?
Believe Ray Palmer and the real life experiences that went into influencing his work.
I actually believe Ray, and the reason I believe it is because of his relationship with Richard Shaver, who was I suspect schizophrenic. He was a welder. He was one of these figures that was a kind of a cult figure in the 40s in the Pulp Fiction world, and Palmer was. The way he related to Shaver is actually very impressive. Shaver was talking about these Darrows, these sort of demons that dwell under the ground and have these ray guns, and he was really literalistic about all of it. I mean, he literally believed all of this, and Palmer didn't.
Hey, Jeffrey, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I shouldn't have asked that question like that, open-ended as it was, because that music tells us we're going into the break. Martha and the Vandellas is taking us into this break. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest, Jeffrey Kripal. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast.